Hello and welcome to the October edition of the Organic Gardening Podcast. I'm Fiona Taylor and in a moment I'll be joined by Chris Collins and Martin Salnikov from our horticultural team. This month it's a bumper episode all about heritage vegetables. At Garden Organic we're gearing up to celebrate 50 years of our brilliant heritage seed library. A huge community effort where our team here works with gardeners and growers all over the country to conserve over 800 varieties of vegetable that would otherwise have died out. To celebrate, we're launching a UK-wide seed relay to highlight the importance of saving and sharing seed. Do keep an eye on our website, gardenorganic.org.uk, for details of how you can join in with our celebrations over the next year. Later on, I chat with Raymond Blanc, OBE, from his kitchen garden at Le Manoir aux Quatre Saisons, where he grows over 100 varieties of heritage vegetables from all around the world. We'll also be answering your questions on saving seeds from squash and rosemary beetle. But now, it's time to catch up with Chris in the potting shed. Hi, Chris. How are you doing?
I'm good, Fiona. How are you?
Yeah, really, really well. Although, feeling that my garden has become really badly neglected. I'm wanting to have a good old catch up with you about how to put that right during October.
Well, there's a lot of changes going on.
We're
hitting the autumn. The seasons are changing. I always liken it to an old friend I haven't seen for a while when
yes.
the season comes along.
Yes.
It's always that, you've got those different feelings of familiarity and nostalgia out of
yeah.
it. But it's a busy time for a gardener. I've had an incredible year for food, to be honest with you. I've been taking so much off that allotment. And things are coming to an end, so gaps are appearing on the allotment.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, the Tommies, I've had so many tomatoes. I've sourced them, I've roasted them, I've cooked them, I've blown them, I'll be smoking them by the end. And it's just like, so you've got this really big glut. They've come out now. The squash and things, I've had a big glut of squash and pumpkin, which has been great as well, but they're coming to the end of beans. So these kind of gaps are opening up on the allotment. And, you know, I've got a compost dome. I've got to think about not having bare soil now. I could use soil. Obviously, I can still sow seeds. There's still seeds
yeah.
time to do that. So it's kind of, I'm lifting stuff, dividing it. So there's still lots going on.
Okay, we're gonna get right into all these things. But I want to ask you a bit more about bare soil because
yeah.
this is the time of year when we need to be vigilant about that. But it's also the time of year where sowing into bare soil isn't necessarily the answer. So it's a little bit late for green manures, although not all of them. So let's have a little think about that. So with your bare patches, what are you doing with them?
Well, I'm getting in some crops that I'm going to be using next year.
Right.
So I've put my onion sets are going in at
yep.
the moment. I have winter potatoes, Mary's Piper, they've gone in as well. So hopefully they're going to get up and cover the soil for me a bit. I plant a lot of brassicas quite late in the summer as well. So kale I'll put in, spring cabbage, that kind of stuff. Quite late in the season, some gardeners might not want to do that. But I know they will sit in the ground and protect the ground over the winter.
Yes.
My parsnips I pull as I need. My carrots I pull as I need.
Yes.
So they all sit in the ground.
So that's your store cupboard.
Yes, basically. Basically, yeah. The gaps I do have, I'll probably put down some mustard seed because it's a very quick germinator. I'm lucky enough to be in London. That might not be so easy to do north of the north because it might be colder and the conditions might not be right. But in London, I get away with it. And there are salad crops, winter salad leaves, mizuma, Chinese mustards. I use all of these as well. So I am still sowing in drills a little bit here and there to plug the gaps.
Okay. And, no harm in doing that. And
no.
If it's a bit wet, I'm a bit worried about the slugs though.
Yeah, that's a chance I have to take, I'm
yes.
afraid. It's funny you should say that because I sowed some stuff in the kitchen garden I look after and it was mustards actually. Edible mustards, and they got hit by slugs.
Okay.
And I wonder about it because I've had a very quiet summer, haven't we? Because it's been so hot. And
yeah.
I wonder whether there's all these ravenous slugs and snails
yes.
ready to get going. But, you know, you do what you can. I'll put my beer traps in and stuff.
Anything that you might raise so that it becomes a stronger plant and then pop that in?
Well, I do sell sow as well. So if I've got a packet of mizuma or winter salad, I'll drill sow and see how it get on. But I also propagate in cells. So I'll actually start them in a polytunnel or even in my front room. So I've got little plants to go in as well, so I kind of hedge my bets a little bit.
So that's a nice thing to be thinking actually, because in October you'd sort of think that it's not really seed sowing season, but actually there are some things you can do and they'll still get strong enough to then pop venom in the ground and then they'll sit there and do their thing probably quite slowly.
Yes, I think so. Yeah. You might end up cropping them next spring. Also, broad beans is another one. I'll use a big patch
yep.
of broad bean. They'll come up, sit in the frosty weather, no problem at all. Actually, you'll get better beans.
And will you
pre-sow those, or will you put them directly into the ground?
I'll direct sow broad beans, So you can see there's a lot going on. Obviously, all my waste or my material was my beans, my runner beans, my French climbing beans, I'll cut them down and lay them on, let them lay on top of the soil.
Okay.
So I'll protect the soil with that foliage and they'll break down. And
all right. So I've got a question for you. So this year, I had a lot of fun with amaranth. Absolute joy of a crop, but I know it's seeds everywhere. I've still got the plumes at the top of the amaranth, which is a sort of a spinach-like plant that grows up to, you know, 1.5 meters perhaps, and then you get these wonderful sort of plumes of seed. Apparently you can eat that seed, but I haven't worked that out. I need to do some investigation and find out more about that, but I'm needing to take the tops off because I don't want the entire veg patch to be given over to amaranth next year, which is what will happen if I leave the seed on. But what I was thinking of doing, with your advice, Chris, is if I chop them down to, say, maybe, I don't know, you know, 20 centimetres or so high, their stalks are quite woody now, and just leave those. That's a good, rather than pulling them out.
I think so, because definitely I'd rather have something there than nothing, really. I mean, I would let, if the choice was there, I'd rather have a gram weedy than bare, because you're protecting that soil. The roots are aerating it and making sure the water drains through it. It's stopping leaching. It's stopping the washing through of nutrients. So anything that protects the soil, you might just want to put cardboard and compost down on top of it. But anything to protect the integrity of the soil, first and foremost, is our job, I think, as gardeners. Yeah.
And also, you're leaving those roots in the soil. We don't really know what life has formed around those roots.
You don't know. And also, just what it's doing is it's making sure the soil drains properly. You're aerating with those roots. So the water's moving through the soil. You've got less chance of waterlogging and damage to the soil that way as well.
Okay. Well, that's a real nice solution, actually, because I was worried about that and thinking that perhaps, they were just going to kind of rot and look awful. But they probably will rot and look awful, but it doesn't matter because the soil is getting what it needs. It's not too late for sowing one particular green manure, and that's Phacelia, isn't it?
Very nice plant. I love Phacelia.
Amazing plant. Yeah. And will still probably germinate. If you get a little patch of mild weather in October, it will still germinate.
It's all about soil temperature. If the soil temperature stays over 5 degrees, then stuff will still germinate, basically. Yeah. So, you know, if you've got frosty day, if the frost comes in and you've got regular frost, it'll be harder. But certainly in the south of England, it might not be the same in Scotland, we'll have a slightly cooler weather, but you'll still got time to do stuff like that. Yeah.
Now, 5 degrees is quite a key temperature, isn't it? Because that's the same level as when grass will grow.
Yes. So
grass grows at 5 degrees or over.
So I use it as an indicator, basically. Yes. I look after quite a lot of lawn area in various jobs I do, so I kind of use it. And actually, after the really dry summer where it hasn't grown at all, the grass is really going on one at the moment.
Yeah. So if the grass is still growing
a bit, you know, the soil temperature's
then
still
then you know
cool.
It's okay to sow some things. Yeah. Okay. That's a top tip. So if you have a patch of lawn that you know that you're fond of or that you look after, what do you need to be doing to your lawn through October?
Well, it's quite an important time, really, for lawns. On a small basic scale, for a back garden or backyard, definitely a bit scarifying. I'd probably get in and take the thatch out. When you take the thatch out, you break the stolon, the underground stems, and that causes it to tiller, gets it thicker. I might spike it if it's heavy soil and it's prone to waterlogging. I will certainly overseed, and I tend to cut my seed now with a lot of use fescues and bents, which are native seeds.
Okay.
All right. And I'll cut that with a bit of clover seed as well.
Okay. Give me those names again.
Fescues and bents. So fescues and bents are incredible grasses. We use them on sports services, bowling greens and cricket pitches are fescues and bents, cricket wickets, because you can shave them right down short and they don't die. They'll come back again.
Okay.
So if you look at a cricket wicket, there's no grass on it at all. They cut it off completely. But then what you'll do is they rotate the wicket and you'll see it grow back in. That's fescues and bents. And so they are, like a lot of people say, for resilient seed, you use rye. That's what rugby pitches are made of. But actually, rye is not a native, whereas a lot of our fescues and bents are. So it's quite a good idea to use those. But cut them with pollinators. Now, so you can put some clover seed in there with it as well. Maybe you can get mixed seed of some with a bit of ranunculus, a bit of buttercup maybe, or achillea. So you've got other pollinators in amongst the lawn as well.
Yeah. Okay. Which brings me on to my project, which is, after all these years, I've been wanting to do this for years and I've never quite done it, but I'm going to do it this year. And that is that I want to turn a proportion of my grass into a wildflower meadow. And I'm not naive about it. I think people think, oh, that's just easy. You just do this, that, and the other, and it'll be fine. And I know it will take a few years to kind of get it right. But in the first instance, I've got some yellow rattle seed that somebody has very kindly passed on to me.
It's not cheap stuff, rattle seed.
Yeah, so this is actually one of our lovely growing partners, a lovely garden over in Wales, Nanty Beth. And Sue there has given me a paper bag of yellow rattle seed that she's harvested from her yellow rattle. So, you know, always best, because you know it's going to be good stuff if somebody's handed it on to you in that way. She was very careful to tell me that I must sow it now, while it's relatively fresh. I mean, it is dry seed, but I need to get on and get it in now. And I needed to stamp it in. Now, I want to ask you, Chris, what do I need to do to prepare the grass in the first place?
Well, you want to, I'll do the same technique with wildflower, actually, if it was exactly the same. I would shave it as short as you can get it, scalp it completely.
Okay. So with the lawnmower?
With a lawnmower, yep, you can do it that way. Probably the best with a lawnmower, because you can put the setting right down low. And what you want to do is you want to expose as much soil as possible.
Okay.
So you don't want any, you want all the crowns off. And then I'd get a lawn rake or a springbok, and I would go over it really harshly with that. So you're scratching up the soil, because what you want to do is you put the seed down, you want it to be touching the soil.
Yeah.
Okay, so you what you want to do is make sure that gets a start, basically.
Yeah.
So lawn rake or springbok, get it, really scratch it up, and then it's about making sure you've got seeds got contact. So you might want to use a heavy roller.
Yeah.
Right, to go over it once you see the soil, or you might want to just stamp it.
Yeah.
Now make sure that crucial part is that soil is touching the soil, and that allows germination.
So the seed absolutely in contact with the soil.
Yes.
Do I need to then cover the seed again?
No, I don't think so. Let's leave it to if it's dry. I mean, it's quite dry. It's been quite dry. I would maybe get a sprinkler on it, maybe.
Okay, if needed. Yeah, okay. When I come to do it, let's see. It feels quite damp, my garden, so I think I might be all right.
Yeah.
Okay, and then my plan is to then, in the spring, to then sow my wildflower seeds then.
Yeah, so it depends what kind of wildflower you want. If it's perennial, you need to do a bit of research to see what suits your conditions. Or you could do them. And this year I did quite a lot of hardy annual wildflowers. Are very good, but you'll get 1 year out of them and they'll they'll expire. Yeah. But they're very quite easy to do and they're always colourful.
I think I want to go perennial and see how that goes. The only thing I'm slightly concerned about is that in my head, a wildflower meadow is something that's, you know, in well lit in full sunshine. I've got quite a lot of trees in my garden, quite a lot of shade in my garden, and I don't think I'm going to be able to avoid
that.
You can
get shady wildflower mixes. There's quite a variety out there, so you can get that. I would certainly add some bulbs to that, some snowdrop maybe.
Good idea.
I'll certainly mix those in as well, because you're always guaranteed to get colour of that. The big problem people have with wildflower gardens is they tend to want low nutrient content, okay? They're colonisers.
Yeah.
So what tends to happen is people sow them, but then the weeds, the cushion stuff, tend to come in and out compete them. Mm. So you go, the first year you might get a lot of flower, but the next year you might not get anything because these competitors come in. Okay. So really, I mean, if I was doing it in an environment professionally, I might even remove the topsoil and sow into that, you see, because you get that very sort of basic. But it's worth a go. It is worth a go. But researching the type of mix is important. So if you've got a good soil and it's shady, there'll be a mix that will suit those conditions.
Right. So this time next year, we'll have a conversation about what I do next.
I'm going to think
positive. I think it's going to be really wonderful.
Well, I just think it's worth trying. Even if you've got a lawn area and you end up introducing a few new species and I get a few bulbs in there, I think the art of it is just to keep adding to it and let it go over time. It's not like most gardening. It's a progressive thing. It's about time. So there's no bang all. It's not a hanging basket.
Instant. Yeah. I mean, it is, of course, the time of year to have a think about some bulbs, isn't it?
Well, I will. My big changeover comes soon. And I'm interested this year because I saved all the ones from last year. I've run out of room out the front of the property. So I've had them in my office on a big drip tray. So I'm going to put them in because I've dried them all through the summer. So I'm going to put some of them in, see if they grow. They're already firm still. So, but the big changeover, which I always enjoy on the balconies, as a balcony garden, is all that seasonal stuff, the colour and the peppers and the tomatoes, is all going to come out now. Mm. And then I'll plant it with bulbs.
And actually do try and get organic bulbs.
Yes, I mean, hopefully we'll see more of them. The thing is with organic bulbs is they're produced almost in like agroforestry conditions. So it's about leaving the bulb in the ground and then letting them form in natural defence. Anything you get mainly in their garden centers and stuff, will be pretty heavy because they're produced just for bulbs. There's a lot of chemical involved. So I think that they tend to be a bit more expensive because they're slower to produce, but there's more and more of them on the market, and it's going to be the way forward, I should imagine.
Mm. And we must support it. We must support this market because there's a shortage of organic bulbs. There's a shortage of organic seed.
Yes,
you know?
Yeah, it is. And exactly. And also that the biodiversity and the genetic base of it is really important.
It's so important. Yeah. Absolutely. So talking of seed, this is our 50th anniversary year for the Heritage Seed
Library. It's very exciting, isn't it?
Amazing. Isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So the Heritage Seed Library, for people who don't know, is an incredible conservation project that this charity started in 1975. Our founder realised that seeds were seeds that fell out of favour, that perhaps fell out of fashion, were basically dying out. So if certain nurseries weren't producing seed anymore because there didn't seem to be a market for it, then nobody would be growing that seed, nobody would be looking after that seed. And then 10 years later, you wouldn't be able to get hold of it.
Yes, Lawrence Hills was a genius in many ways, because also you had the impact of the EU, joining the EU, and what that meant is every seed had to be licensed. So the traditional way of us passing seed around, head gardener to head gardener, allotment holder, allotment, became under threat because it can be licensed. So he recognised that.
Yeah.
And he recognised, well, we're going to lose this valuable genetic base of seed, localised a lot of it. And so he recognised that and set up the Heritage Seed Line. I think as a gardener, it's one of the most ingenious moves any gardeners ever made throughout the history of gardening, recognising their importance. And the fact we're 50 years later and it's still going strong, and Katrina and her team are still going at it alone, is a very big thing to celebrate, actually.
It is, and it's the largest community seed bank in the whole of Europe.
Yep.
It's, you know, it's an extraordinary effort. And what happens is we are sent seed by people who want to make sure that it is conserved for future generations. We then grow that seed out, test it, make sure it's viable. And then after that, we then open it up for the wider community. The idea of the library is that as many people as possible can get hold of this seed. You do need to belong because it's a conservation effort and it costs money to do it, I'm afraid. And we've got about 8,000 members of the Heritage Seed Library.
I think that it's genius in a way that it brings together the two things we represent. It brings together seed and the conservation of seed and the importance of that, but it brings together people as well. The two things come into the pot, and I just think that's quite a special mix. I really do.
Absolutely. And one of the ways we want to celebrate it is we're launching the first ever seed relay.
Yes, I think I'm going to be involved.
I think you're a part. I hope you've got your running gear sorted out, Chris. Yeah, so every single seed that is taking part in the seed relay has got golden either in the title, or it becomes a golden fruit, because obviously it's the golden anniversary of the Heritage Seed Library at 50 years. So that's a lovely thing to start with. And we're going to start in Bocking over in Essex. And that, of course, is where our founder, Lawrence Hills, began with his trial garden. He had a couple called Alan and Jackie Gear working with him. They're going to meet us in Bocking, and we're going to kick off the relay from Bocking, which is really exciting. And the seed is going to be passed from person to person, and eventually it will end up here at Garden Organic, just outside Coventry. And it's going to land here just before the Heritage Seed Library opens its annual seed list. And what the seed list is if you're a member of Heritage Seed Library, every year you can select 6 varieties of seed, and then we send those out to you. So it's well worth becoming a member, and especially this year, because it's such a special year. Yeah,
it's worth saying, and I've just gone through a season of doing this. There's a big important thing for me about growing heritage seed. It's for taste. The taste of the veg I produce from Heritage Seed is incredible. It really is. There's no comparison, I don't think, between hybridised F1 and Heritage Seed. It's been an absolute joy to eat off the allotment this year where it's all been Heritage Seed. For that reason alone, I think it's worth growing.
Yeah. I mean, we're going to be talking about it over and over again over the next year, just to say that all the seed in the Heritage Seed Library is open pollinated. And that's what makes it so exciting, because it's easy to share with people. It's not been bred in a laboratory. It's been bred by people who've crossed things in their gardens, in their allotments. They've selected the carrot that looks, you know, the juiciest, selected the lettuce that's perhaps grown the largest or has a certain colour to it. And then they've grown those seeds the following year to make that a larger lettuce, a juicier carrot. And they've done that because that's what they want to eat. And that's why things taste better, because it's been done by...
It's been selected by gardeners.
Mm, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's gardening at its finest. It's what it's all about, that connection with the soil, looking what grows well, looking what tastes best. And it's just so rewarding. It really is.
Yeah. The reason we've gone for a relay is because we just want to emphasise that if you pass seed on to people, that is the best thing. Seed is meant to be sown, isn't it? You know, it's not meant to be just kind of sat on the shelf. It's meant to be sown. And if you've got a surplus, pass it on. So we're passing it on through this relay, and also talking a lot about how to save seed so that you can pass it on, how to share it, how you can get involved in community seed swaps. And the whole thing, if you want to find out more, there's going to be loads of information on our website, on our social media, or join us and you'll get the newsletter, find out more. The relay will be across England between now and Christmas. And then in the new year, we're taking the relay across to Wales, up to Scotland, and we're finishing up in Ireland. So we're really going for it because, if anything, the Heritage Seed Library is perhaps a little bit of an unknown national treasure.
It is. And I think we need to sing as loudly as we can about it. And I think our 50th anniversary of it is a really good way to do that. I think we need to get the trumpets out on this one.
This month, I visited Le Manoir aux Quatre Saisons, where I was joined by Raymond Blanc, OBE. Visiting Le Manoir was a real treat. We toured around their beautiful and highly productive kitchen garden. Raymond spoke with me about the importance of heritage food in the kitchen, how he works with gardeners and chefs to discover the vegetable varieties with the very best taste, and why it's important to support the next generation of gardeners. I asked him first to tell us all about his kitchen garden.
Wow, it's everything. The kitchen garden is absolutely everything. It's this where I grow my gastronomy. Gardens are part of my life. That's what I was given as a young kid. We're a family of seven, and the garden would feed the family of seven all year round, because all will be picked. And I remember picking up tons of beans that I had to top and tail, peas that I had to pod, you know, and then my mum would apply a simple art of cooking and preserving, and it was either frozen or it was preserved and for the winter. So by the age of 8 or 10, I had a deep understanding of the soil. My papa made me taste earth at the age of 7. And then it's only by 14 when I dare to ask my papa, ask him, okay, Papa, I understand why you asked me to look at earth, because if the earth is beige and sticky, it's clay, so a lot of root vegetables won't be growing. If it's slightly reddish, it's irony. Okay, so it's, and etc. So, okay, I understand. Smelling it, I don't quite understand. But why on earth did you make me taste it? And I understood my father actually had a sense of humor, because he said that was a joke. But actually, beyond that joke, it's quite interesting. It made me actually study a bit the earth, and we all know now that a handful of earth has got more micro particles than the whole world. It's highly complex. And I'm talking about here good earth. So obviously, that was one of my first experiences, but we have a deep understanding of seasonality. Variety was the most important thing. When my mom asked me to go, Raymond, get me some rat. I knew it was rissolet. Raymond, get me some shallot potato. I knew it was salads. Raymond, get me some belle de fontenay. You know, I knew it was poaching. Okay, served just warm with a bit of dressing, and it was just divine. So every variety had a culinary use, whereas in England, a potato was a potato.
It's a potato, exactly. Voilà. That's so true, isn't it? So I can imagine in growing up, it sounds like you were worked very hard in your garden.
I've kept really the heritage of what my mum passed on to me. Okay, food is an act of love. Okay, and of course, the garden, that's where everything begins.
You talked about your mother growing different varieties for different purposes, and I must assume therefore in your kitchen garden here you're going to have many different varieties of certain vegetables. Talk us through salads and lettuce, for example.
Salads, for example, my mum would always grow as early as would be basically the Batavia, the Reine des Glaces, which to me is the Reine des Glaces ice queen, is the very best, represent to me the best lettuce, because it's crunchy, it's got beautiful texture. It's got a beautiful heart, white, and it's got a more bitter leaves outside. It's beautiful to look at. Okay, the name is fantastic as well. And it goes very easy. It goes very easy. And right through the summer. And the Reine des Glaces, she's one of my favorite. But she grows a lot of Batavia. We go Frise. Of course, we go Mash in the winter. So the lettuce for me, I love the texture. I love to bite into a salad leaf.
You do all your lettuce and salad here, don't you?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
So we're about to enter the vegetable garden, which goes about 120 varieties according to the year. Okay. Please come through.
Okay. Just going through the archway into the kitchen garden, which is absolutely beautiful, but also abundant. There is so much growing here. Where do we start? Give us a rundown.
So we grow of these seeded salads. So that you have the arcade, okay, which is a form of romaine. You've got the red lettuce here. That's toiles, okay? Some of it is toiles. We have never grown that one, so we're going to test them. Okay, the whole pond. And then that's why you see the work with the relationship between the garden and the kitchen. That means all these trials, we will have proper testing, okay, maybe of 6 or 8 or 10 varieties, more lettuce, okay, over here that we're trialing. And the gardener tests the food, whether it is a trial of apples, a trial of potatoes, the chef cooks the fruit of the work of the garden, of the gardener, and we test it.
So everyone's involved. So the people growing the variety and then the chefs cooking, they all are checking things.
Yes.
And so these trials are just going on all the time.
Yeah. And that allows a teamwork, respect for each other's craft is very, very important. And you create, you know, something, a better understanding of what the work is. But we've done that for many years. The Italian has, which we are trialing at the moment.
It's got a beautiful, bright green leaf.
And quite a thick leaf.
Quite thick, definitely. A lot of bite in it.
So it's always looking at flavor profile, taste and texture. Absolutely. That's the fennel at the moment. So it's overgrown and for good reason, we want to keep the seed. And so we use that for the pollen to brush the fish to give that lovely aniseed flavor.
Yes. Okay.
Then we'll cut the fennel at the base here to dry all these stalks of fennel to dry them, which will serve as a bed for roasting a fish. And you baste it with olive oil, okay, with the orange, with the lemon, the star anise, and you have really a beautiful dish, which is set on the bed of fennel.
Yeah.
And you roast it. So everything is really reused, kept, you know. I don't know this variety of leek, but to me, but that is one of the oldest varieties, the Salaire. The Salaire is the most oldest French variety. And no leek rot, a very healthy variety, which will be ready to pick up in about 2 months' time, month and a half time. Okay. And it's very gentle. It's not got that oniony strong flavor. It's very gentle and very tender as well. So that's why we grow it. And that's what my father would go as well at home. I want to reconnect completely with the best. That means we have to restart trials, okay, to eventually find what is the best leek, what is the best salad, what is the best turnip, what is the best whatever. It's finding the best to give our guests the very best food experience from the garden.
We've just arrived at two beautiful rows of sweet corn, I think possibly my favourite veg, actually. So this one's called Golden Bantam. The one next to it is a French variety, Dauman. But you've also grown here the Phil Bannister's white corn, which is a Heritage Seed Library variety. And I know that your gardeners were incredibly clever because it's very, very hard to grow Phil Bannister's white corn and for it to come true and be absolutely perfect. And we get a lot of comments from people saying, oh, I tried it, but it crossed with some other corn and it wasn't pure. But here, of course, it was pure white and it was a great success. But tell me a little bit about what you do with sweet corn here at the Manoir.
Well, sweet corn, you can either, obviously, we like to use the corn. So we cut it often to prepare it. We can cut it with leaving a little bit of that root on it, so the corn old. And we blanch it very lightly and grill it. A bit of spice as well. Lemon juice is essential because corn, of course, is sweet. So a bit of spice, like espalette, okay, will give it such a length of flavor. And lemon juice is crucially important. So we brush it with a bit of olive oil as well. So we can remove all the grains and serve it as part of, now you've got all the game which is coming in, like venison, like grouse. So we use it a lot, because that add beautiful texture, sweetness as well to the dish, and makes the dish much more grander, much more delicious.
Walking past all this mint and it's just cloud, the scent is incredible.
When I came back from Southeast Asia, China and other countries, I brought a lot of ideas to this garden, and I always wanted to grow a Southeast Asian garden. So that's the Southeast Asian garden. It's not as beautiful as we would like to, because we were so short. John was so short. There was so much busy this year. Diggers had to go all through here. So this part of the garden is not being used. But here you got about all the Korean mint, okay? You got the beautiful Vietnamese mint. Lemongrass is a beautiful history. I tried for 17 years to grow lemongrass. 17 years! John was not even here at the time. Were you?
No, I was here for the trials. Okay. We were trying out, yeah.
But anyway, it was really a disaster every year. You know, we would cover it with straw and with some cloth on top to protect it from the cold. But every year, every spring, I would look at the ground, it would be all rotten. Until 17, we changed varieties, and we eventually chose a Himalayan variety, which is normally made for perfume. And suddenly I was expecting a disaster again after 17 years. And I removed the straw, and then I saw those shoots. And I was the happiest man on earth.
Oh, there's three beautiful plants here of lemongrass. I've never seen it growing like that in this country. It absolutely looks beautiful. I mean, it could be in the flower beds, couldn't it?
The flavour is quite extraordinary.
Oh, that is a rough texture.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Very rough and cutting as well.
But the smell.
The smell is beautiful.
Yeah.
So much for I did a room as well around citronelle. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So you've got amaranth here. That's a variety which is called cognac.
It's an absolutely extraordinary plant. I mean, it looks prehistoric, doesn't it?
Yes, well, it's very old. This one is about 1600 old variety. And it's not ready yet. That will be forked out, taken out in about a month's time.
Can I, while we're walking through the Southeast Asian garden, it's just an idea has popped into my head, a question I wanted to ask you. I think that one of the things that you believe is that we use too much sugar in our cooking, and I just wonder how do you make jams and things like that to avoid overuse of sugar and drowning.
We use only in our jams 20% of sugar, and we all know that sugar is a flavor, it's also a preservative, and that's why traditionally jams have been done with 100% sugar, 100% fruit, and that you can keep it forever. But what you have is something unhealthy and oversweet. Okay, so at the Manoir, we're working on all our jams on 20% sugar, but you cannot keep them as long as other jams, okay? And it's got to be kept refrigerated, and we can only keep them for 1 month. So as we work with seasons, it's all right, because strawberries, it will be strawberry 1 month, after it will be raspberries, after it will be blackberries. Okay, so we have, so again, working with the season, I think it's so important to work with the season. If you import your food, most of the food we eat is imported, at least 80% of our food, which is a shame, really. And we should help our gardeners far more, you know, to reinvent agriculture. And there's a climate which fits now. It's much warmer. The seasons are much longer. So I think there's so many possibilities. So for me, importing food from thousands of miles away, first, that food is totally full of pesticide, reeking of pesticide, fertilizers, sulfate, copper, fungicide, etc. Maybe 20 applications or more. Okay, then you have to fry them. That's the second form of pollution. Then you have to clean up the pollution. And what do you get? A strawberry in the middle of January? What flavor has it got? Okay, and the pollution and the the pollution added to it, it doesn't make any sense. Wait for that best strawberry is going to start in the end of, start in February in France. We start in early June in England. And for 2 months, you have a glut of strawberries, beautifully homegrown strawberries, which will have color, flavor, nutrients. And you will help your farmer as well by buying seasonally. And of course, when there's a glut, the price goes down. So that's time to make your jams. It's time to make, it makes so much more sense to buy locally and seasonally, because you have better flavor, better texture, colors, nutrients, and of course it's half of the price because there's a glut of it. There's a glut of strawberries, a glut of carrots, a glut of cabbage, whatever. So it makes sense.
And something that you said has really struck home with me about earlier, we talked about successional sowing, so you've got salad all year round, but you've just talked about successional cooking. I just love this idea that you cook the strawberries at that time. You'll get a little bit longer of the season because you've got another month with that jam, but then you move on to the next thing. So it's like successional cooking. So rather than our tradition, which is, oh, you know, and I talk myself, I made a whole load of plum jam last night. I was appalled at the amount of sugar.
Did you put in?
Yeah, far too much. Yeah. Because I thought, I want this to keep. I want to be having plum jam in March. Well, actually, why do I need that?
There's a whole succession. Look at the season. Now we have the Mirabelle. We have the damsons later on. We'll have the blackberries with my pâtisserie and Monsieur Benoit, who's been with me for 30 years, who I adore and I think is the greatest craftsman. But my God, as a Frenchman, coming from a classical background, sugar was everything. And I had so many fights, but eventually I won those fights, or he let me win it, or he was too tired to fight with me. Okay, and we have now all low sugar, jams, local sugar, desserts, and you see the difference. The flavors are fresh, are clean, because if you have a ripe fruit, it's... the sugar is built beautifully through the season, so it's ready to be picked and ready to be enjoyed into a beautiful dessert, and you need less sugar. Buying seasonally, to me, that makes a great deal of sense, because that's when it's when there's a glut of strawberries, they are the cheapest. There's a glut of cabbage, they are the cheapest. And if we follow those seasons, we will be able to maybe to help the health of the whole nation just by eating better.
Can gardeners be part of that solution?
I think gardeners have got to be helped by the government, farmers as well. Okay, I think we've seen all the issues, the big issues about our farmers. And I think that's a section of the population and craft which have been totally undermined. Okay, where there's so much potential. Why should we import 70 or 80% of our food from elsewhere when we could grow at least 70% of it? And commercially viable as well. So I think there's some sorts of it to really reinvent agriculture, and there's a possibility of it. I really believe it, especially in our climate. Look, the wine we're making now in UK, the cheese we are making. Now, look, take the cheese, for example. And I know it's got nothing to do with vegetables. Actually, there's a lovely moment where General de Gaulle raised his arms. And he was saying, how can you govern a country which has got 350 cheese? Impossible. Now, in England, we have more than 700 cheese. So I see big problems brewing in England. Okay? But look how this cheese making has grown up. So why not vegetables? Now it is beautiful. The artisans are brilliant. Our chefs are fantastic. So there's a big transformation in this country. And I really believe, you know, we have extraordinary gardeners. We've got extraordinary craftsmen, whether it's cheese makers or farmers and so on. So I think we can definitely, with a bit of help, reinvent our farming.
So more vegetables here, less importing.
For example, we talk about vegan. I will show you my book later on. 80% of my book is about vegetables. And great dishes, fantastic dishes, easy dishes, you know, dishes which are also healthy. Because we look at the vegetables and we still see them. It's a stigma of the 70s, you know. I remember a vegetable was a garnish. That's a garnish. That's no more than that. I was the first chef, probably, to have a vegetarian menu in 1994. Anyone was looking at me, I was crazy. What's that? And nobody took it, of course, because we're all carnivorous. But look now, there's an evolution, and we know now good health doesn't need to be vegan, but to bring more vegetables into our diet is very, very important, okay, and delicious as well. And I've got so many beautiful dishes which are made from vegetables, from herbs, and it's quite miraculous and magical and delicious.
We want the best, don't we? That's the thing. And all your trials, are testament to that. And in this whole area of beans, there is a Kew Blue, which is one of the Heritage Seed Library varieties.
And I remember I was in Kew. I did a program on Kew many years ago, a TV program, and I discovered that bean there. And immediately I brought it in here. And I think being part of the seed library is quite, still today, is one of the greatest beans you can have. And it grows plenty. There's a good yield. It's easy to grow as well. It's not a fussy vegetable, you know. Even its dryness, you know, it's done very, very well. And I love it because it's got such beautiful dark blue. Almost purple sheen. Of course, when you cook it, the chlorophyll goes off, you know, and it goes back to green, but the flavor is unbelievable, really. So it's really worth going to this bean because it's a very easy bean to grow. It's local as well. It belongs to UK. It belongs to Kew. It belongs to all of us here. Okay, don't have to import the seeds from anywhere else. Okay.
Yes.
And it's to me one of the greatest success. Okay.
Yeah.
And someone even better than many varieties of French beans that I know.
The thing that's really striking me as we're walking around is that pretty much everything we've talked about is a heritage variety, whether it's from Italy, whether it's from France. And these are varieties that have been passed down through generations. You know, in some ways, to you, it's completely natural to grow heritage varieties. To other people, it's a novelty. So how do we make it normal? How do we normalize heritage?
It's going to be very difficult because commercially, the supermarkets deliver the most fruit and vegetables, buy in bulk, in big bulk. The fruit has got to be absolutely not a single bit of a default. The fruit has got to be big. The fruit has got to be the most beautiful color, so it's attractive to the eye. Too often it undermines, it's not about the taste. Okay, it's about how it looks, and it's often very disappointing. To biases, and of course, it could be resistant to a known disease. So that's how we grow food today. And we are more and more forgetting the flavor. And in this seed library, organic values, you have the flavor. In heritage varieties, you have extraordinary flavor. So that's why we go, and that's what my papa gave me, all this value. And that's why with John, okay, and his team, We're still growing these vegetables the way we do because we see our guests smiling, you know, and the chefs understand better the gardener. The gardener understands better the chef. You create a better team, more focused team, and it's quite beautiful to see.
And so it's the stories behind, but the stories are usually because of the flavor. That's why people have kept seed going down the generations.
Well, we keep seeds to make sure that if something terrible happens, those seeds will be able to be reused and planted and so on. So that's one part of it. But of course, it's about flavor. It's about flavor. And flavor for me is everything. Flavor and texture as well.
And something I really would love to talk to you more about is you grow these varieties here. Obviously, they go into the kitchen. but you must then save the seed of the best ones. And I just want to ask a little bit about the seed saving operation that goes on.
We've done a heritage garden, and I did this heritage garden about 20 years ago, especially for that reason, for seed saving and protecting something which belongs to us. And it's been quite successful. And we, at one stage, it was abandoned. We just rebuilt it this year. And you have here, from Seed Library, about 50 vegetables that we have grown. And let me show you the heritage garden. I'm introduced August. So August is actually looking after the heritage garden. And she's in charge. She's leading the Raymond Blanc Gardening School. Yeah. And she's got a course today. Huh?
Yes, I have. Absolutely. So we've been teaching edible gardens. So we're talking all about microbes, but we've also been sharing some of the beautiful varieties that we have here, which are all from the Heritage Seed Library. So we've got around about 50 different varieties, I believe, that we are growing. And some of them literally just set my heart on fire. So which is one of these here, which is the Phil Bannister's White. And I remember the first time I came to Garden Organic to see the gardens, I was just like, oh my goodness, there was this corn growing and there was all jewellery bags over the corn. And I know that you tried to grow it for 2 years and basically it didn't come true. And the variety was, it's called Phil Bannister's White. And Phil Bannister had grown it on his allotment for 50 years and sadly passed away. Nobody can look after it. And obviously what you do is you protect and preserve these incredible varieties for future generations. And I'll show you here. So we've got, this is our second generation. So I think you had the final seeds before the whole variety disappeared and it was not to be grown again. And you managed to grow it true in the last year. And I received a cob in the post. Now, I don't know if anybody's ever received a cob of corn. You know, there's something lovely about getting the seeds in a packet. But when you get a cob, I was like, this is the Phil Bannister's White Cob. Oh,
because at that point, there were so few of them in the world.
In the whole world. Yeah. And I was like, Sam, we've got this wonderful variety. And I remember Katrina saying to me, you know, it's really hard to grow. Are you actually going to be able to grow this variety true? And I was thinking, no, probably not. So we grew 400 of this Phil Bannister's White corn in this wave here. And I remember Katrina came for a seed sowing course in the Raymond Blanc Gardening School. So she taught all of our guests how to save seeds. And each guest pulled a cob of the Phil Bannister's White off of the plant, opened it up, and her jaw dropped to the floor. It was white, and we had managed to grow it true. And it was so then we managed to send thousands of seeds back to you in the post, which then came out to all of your members. And basically, it now says grown at Le Manoir, which is beautiful.
Which is really, really beautiful on so many levels and extraordinary, because we could not do what we do at the Seed Library without our seed guardians. But you are up there as such a special place and taking on a very, very difficult seed to replicate Phil Bannister's White is up there. So, you know, we are immensely grateful. And you know, it's one of the reasons why Raymond Blanc is our Vice President for the Heritage Seed Library.
Yeah, it's been a great honour to be part of this extraordinary adventure, especially at Le Manoir. But it's very easy to understand. It's my childhood, it is my region, it is my parents, both my papa and maman, who is a sculpture of my mom here, who basically was one of the greatest gardeners I've known, the greatest cook I've known, who has created really this interest in garden, this great interest in food and in people, because that's what it's all about. You grow food to be cooked and to be given to friends and to families. That's what it's all about. And it's been an extraordinary adventure. There's 12 gardens here. Soon there will be 17. There's an art school being done. There's a bee village. There's a vineyard being done. You know, it's a beautiful orchard we have with most of it is heritage varieties, which has 125 varieties of apples and all the other varieties, pears, plums, damsons, quinces, apricot, peaches, are all French heritage or British heritage. So I think there's a knowledge now which is, and a vision which is shared and owned by everyone, and that's what it's all about.
It's keeping it because alive, isn't it?
And, but you can so only important. Keep it alive if you pass it on, like yes. August Ron, sorry, Mont Blanc with school, and create this beautiful heritage garden. And next year, we're going to work together on this garden together,
even
to make it even more beautiful, more interesting, and work a little bit with the seed library. So, because it's difficult, you know, the problem we have had here is really. We think of test, okay? And sometimes there's not enough seed library, okay? In order, there's only 800 varieties, and we need to bring it up at least to 2,000 so we can have all the vegetables represented and being part of the seed library. So that's basically our aim, okay? That's our mission, to make it happen.
And if you had one piece of advice to give a gardener that would connect them to their heritage, what would that advice be?
That's a big one, that one. I think it's to reconnect with our past, because through our past, we can understand our future truly, and we can make our future much better. And teach your child, okay, the magic of these seeds. That's a big, strong beginning, because children need to be involved, need to understand. We are so separated from the food and the food we grow and where it's grown. Okay, most people still believe it comes from Marcus Spencer and so on. So I think these young kids need to be, that's the next generation we need to care of for, and give them all of our values. By your child, for example, you may not quite like it, appreciate it to start with, but with a little box that you can put by the side of the window, you know, and you can grow his seeds. You know, that's what we're teaching here. The extraordinary importance of that seed, but it feeds the whole world. It feeds the whole family. So I think passing on the knowledge to children, I think, is very important.
Time now for us to answer some of your questions. So I'm joined by Martin Salnikov from the Heritage Seed Library. Hi, Martin.
Hello.
And I'm joined by Chris Collins.
Hi, Fiona.
All right. So the first one is all about rosemary beetle. I've just found an iridescent beetle-like bug on my rosemary. Do you know what it is? And should I be worried? And this was from Anne. So, Chris, should Anne be worried about this?
Well, I would say, shortly, I would say no, actually. No. I first came across this at Westminster Abbey when I was gardening there, on rosemary, in fact, and also found it on lavender. It's come in maybe on other plants from Southern Europe, probably, from the Mediterranean area. That's why it likes plants like lavender, rosemary, sage. I think you'll get it on. I've never seen it in massive numbers. I've seen it do a bit of damage, a bit of foliage damage, but it hasn't decimated a plant. It's not like spider mite, which could kill a whole plant, or a slug, which will strip a plant. So you'll get some minimal damage. And I think two things, really. One is it's very beautiful.
It is absolutely beautiful.
It's stunningly to look at. Yeah. It really is. And two, it'll be part of a food chain. I know that, you know, there'll be other animals that will feed on it and feed on its larva. And so I think it's playing a little role in nature.
Yeah.
So I think that my advice would be, don't panic.
Yeah.
There's no need to panic. If you're really worried about it, you know, just pick it up, take it to the local park. You know, you just do something like that, remove it from sight. So I think, yeah, I don't think there's anything too much to worry about.
Yeah, okay. I mean, they like other plants too as well. They like lavender and sage. So they're quite a likely creature in a herb bed. So we're not going to worry about rosemary beetle. So that's good. Let's move on. Just in case people aren't sure and have never seen one of these, Martin, can you describe a rosemary beetle?
Yeah, sure. It's about 6 millimeters long. It's a metallic purple with green stripes, a really stunning thing. The larvae that you may not even realize you've got them as well, they usually come at the same time from the previous generation. They're sort of grayish with sort of darker stripes on them.
Okay, lovely. Right, moving on to seed saving. This is actually one member of our team who snuck this question in. But what she says is she's made a real effort to save her own seeds this year and wants to make sure that she stores them as well as possible. What's the best way to keep your seeds safe through the winter? So, Martin, going to have to ask you this.
So there's two components to it that are paramount, moisture and temperature. And if you could choose only one of them, moisture would be the priority, I would say. I think if you've got a fairly nice sort of airy house and you can put them even on the shelf in the room temperature to drop the moisture level to about 10% or even lower if you can, that would be great. If you drop moisture level to 5 to 10%, then you can store it in the fridge. Bottom of the fridge is about 4 or 5 degrees, and that's perfect for longer term storage.
But I always worry about putting them in the fridge because of this. I sort of think, well, isn't that going to cause condensation if I've got a glass jar of seeds in the back of the
fridge? Yeah, that is the problem. Again, it goes back to moisture, but if you can store it in the fridge in an airtight container at the right moisture level, then you should be perfectly fine. What I would say, if you're not sure and you've done it before, things go moldy, maybe try to work on your moisture content. There is a very sort of simple homemade method of making sure that the moisture level is perfect. But what we tend to sort of advise to people, use the rice, put it in the oven for a few hours on 100 degrees to make sure the moisture is extracted from the rice. And that's normal cooking rice
we're talking about.
And once it's cooled down, you put it with the seeds that you've got. Seed needs to be ripe as well. So make sure when you collect the seeds, the right stage as well. You don't want very fresh green seeds. If we're talking about beans, you make sure the pod is nice and crispy and leathery and usually brown in color. You can sort of knock on the pod and you're gonna hear that sort of rattling sound that the seeds are already detached and ready to be harvested. So with that rice, the proportion is usually 6 to 1, and that's 6 parts of rice to 1 part of seeds. For anything size-wise to about pea size, you were talking about a week, and anything pea size and bigger, probably a couple of weeks in that rice, in the jar, to extract that moisture.
Okay, so I understand now. I thought you meant that you stored it alongside the rice sort of through the duration of the winter and spring, but you're using the rice to make sure that that seed is absolutely as dry as possible.
Yeah. You just drop in the moisture level. So the rice will extract the moisture from the seed. Again, 7 to 14 days. After that, airtight container, kilner jar or anything like that, bottom of the fridge is fine. If you're thinking about longer term storage, you can put it in the freezer while it's really a dry, and that's going to give you many, many years. But yeah, if you're not sure after 7 or 14 days, especially with the beans and bigger seeds, thumbnail test is perfect. You basically try to squeeze your thumbnail into the seed. If it marks, that means it's not dry enough. If it doesn't, that means it's ready for longer storage. And on the shelf, easily for a couple of years. If you're out of direct sunlight and any moisture, probably even 5 years. In the fridge or freezer, way, way longer.
Okay. Well, I'm sitting here feeling a bit, you know, like I need to up my game. I mean, you know, in my house, it goes into a jar and it sits on a sunny windowsill. That's probably wrong, isn't it? It probably needs to be in the dark. That's the first thing. It's hit and miss as to whether I get mould or not. I think things could improve.
They could do. That's funny, isn't it? Always when seed, one thing that amazed me about them is obviously you mentioned 5 to 10% moisture content. So remember when you watch like a science fiction film and they go in those status beds and they shut down for 6 months? Basically, a seed does that. It just, as a form of life, it closes right down, minimal moisture level, and it waits till its time is right.
I mean, you're bringing it back from the dead.
You are, pretty much. So, and that's why they've been around longer than anything else. You could easily do 5 or 6 PhDs on it, I should imagine.
Well, I expect over the next year, we'll do quite a lot of podcasts about seeds because we're just coming into celebrating the 50th anniversary of our Heritage Seed Library.
So it's an exciting year.
Yeah, really exciting.
Very much so.
Going to go a bit more specialist now. Sue has written in. She says, I have successfully grown a very respectable Lady Godiva pumpkin this year from Heritage Seed Library seeds. I want to eat the seeds. And I've read online that they need to be taken quickly before they germinate inside the fruit. Please, can you advise when it's best to harvest the seeds to eat? Now, Lady Godiva squash is a very special vegetable. And actually, I think, if I'm right, it's grown precisely for this reason, to eat the seeds. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I think it's quite an old variety, first commercially available in America in the 70s, but actually came from a chance mutation in 1934 on the field with other squashes. One basically didn't have any husk on it, so it was a breakthrough in terms of making pumpkin seed oils and extracting it much easier.
So the seed doesn't have a husk,
yeah.
And so it's become known as a naked seed, hence why it's called Lady Godiva.
Yeah, nothing to do with Coventry, I'm afraid. Yeah, it's all about the naked seed.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right. And what's the best way to eat those huskless seed?
So when we grew it for the first time, obviously, when we go through the first year of new things, the trials are, you know, quite complicated. But part of the trials is eating a lot of things as well and trying it at different stages. And to be honest, if it's ripe, if it's unripe, doesn't really matter. The seeds are really big and juicy and nice. I would say the best sort of flavor and storage will be when the pumpkin or squash itself is ripe. So Lady Godiva has got like a nice green striping on it, but the fruit itself should go orange. Once it starts turning the color, that means the ripeness is almost there. And once you harvested that one, it shouldn't have any seeds germinating inside. We have had seeds basically waking up and germinating inside, but that's usually when you try to produce seeds, viable seeds, like we do for distribution and all that. So after harvest, you tend to store the squashes on the benches in the cold glass house for 5-6 more weeks. And at that point, it's just a chance. We open one at every 2-3 weeks and check what's going on. And if they start germinating, we need to open all of them. And
so in other words, they're unlikely to germinate in a kind of domestic setting. You know, you're actually saving them to germinate because of the Heritage Seed Library. But if you've got squashes, Lady Godiva squashes in your garden and you harvest them when they're ripe, and then you take the seeds out at that point, that's going to be the time to harvest them and eat them. Can you store the seeds to eat?
You can store the seeds again because they don't have the husk. The sort of may be prone to a deterioration a bit quicker. And if there is any moisture left in it, you may have some molds forming, etc. So again, you would probably try to do some sort of a drying process with them as well if you want to store them for longer.
So when you say husk, so basically you're eating just the embryo.
So it's got the embryo and it's got the life and the food for embryo. So there's no none of that sort of creamy brown sort of tough layer on it. There is that paper thin cellophane like layer on it, especially after drying. But yeah, you can eat it straight out of the fruit, fresh, amazing.
Into a salad or something like that. Yeah,
and the decent size, they're really delicious. So yeah, highly recommended. And it's a very productive squash. It's a sprawler, so if you have one plant, you'll probably cover most of your garden.
Well, yeah. I'm going to try this next year. I think I've never tried this before. This is a, you know, what about being a gardener is you, there's always something new to try and learn, isn't there? And that's a great example of it.
Okay. Now, we have been asked that it can be quite risky to save seed from squashes because they could be toxic. That's a big question. Is there a danger that could be the case if you save seeds from squashes?
Yeah, there is always a danger in a cucurbit family. I think cucumbers and melons and squashes are, they do have a compound that is very bitter and unpleasant to our stomachs. It's called cucurbitacin. And while the forms before they were domesticated and some of the ornamental forms that weren't bred and selected for consumption, will have quite high levels of them. So if you were growing a squash or your cucumber in your garden and there was some sort of happy bee or any other pollinator coming with the pollen from wild ones or ornamental that are sort of closer related to the wild ones, it may cross and cause the level of the compound to jump again. So when you're eating your squash that you've grown this year, you won't see the effect. It's only when you save the seed and the next generation that you grow, you will see the potential jump in the toxins. Yeah, it needs to be crossed with the wild variety that's got a very high level of it.
So you need to keep them in isolation then if you want them to not get toxic, basically. If you were growing a squash and that squash, you don't want anything crossing with it and that stops the toxins.
Ideally, yeah. If you want to keep, you've got favourite squash and you want to grow it for years and years and years, make sure your neighbours don't grow any ornamentals, there's no wild forms around. And yeah, if you can sort of make sure the pollination is a bit more controlled, and there are some sort of easy ways of pollinating by hand, and you can use the brush or you can use the male flower straight in a female flower, and the lovely big petals on the flower once you pollinate it. So usually they open in the morning. You just have to time it quite well. Once you pollinate it, you close those petals with an elastic band, so no other sort of pollination vectors can go in. And that way, yeah, you're making sure you only crossed it with the stuff you want, with the same variety, for example.
So, okay, so let's just kind of make this much clearer then. So if you've grown a squash this year and it's turned out exactly as you expected, then there's no problem. You've got the seeds from the squash, no problem. Sow it again next year. If you sow it again next year and it changes in any way, so the squash looks a bit different, then you know that there's been some cross-pollination. That's when you've got to worry about the seeds.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But the seeds aren't going to kill you. So basically, you just don't get a nice tasting edible. Instead, you get something that is you don't want to eat.
Honestly, with some of the toxic ones, you just
wouldn't eat it.
No, if it's tiny amount of bitterness, it's perfectly fine. You can have it. So if you worry, then it looks slightly different. What I would say is before you do anything else with it, before cooking or any other preparation, slice it and just touch it, or put it on your tongue and sort of taste it. If it's very bitter as raw, just discard it. Start again.
And if you end up with a squash that's a bit of a funny shape or a bit of a different colour, not as you expected, and so therefore has cross-pollinated, you're not sure what it's going to have cross-pollinated with, then what you can do is treat it as an ornamental. And you've got a lovely story, haven't you, on that?
Yes, so, well, gourds, originally, a lot of the old boy gardeners, when I've joined on the parks, this is a proper old boy anecdote of a gardener. The first thing I had to do was go down and collect gourds for my foreman, which is, you know, the same family, etc. And they were ornamental, as Martin says. They might be possible for if they crossed fertilised with a sweet one, with an edible one, they might cause problems. But back then, we didn't think about that. In fact, back then, I don't think we were even... We weren't even eating squashes, yeah, because it just hadn't come onto the market. And obviously, now they're more... We eat them all the time. I grow them all the time. But it was quite nice. So I'd go down with a trug, which is one of them little sort of handhold wooden,
lovely,
old-fashioned trug.
Yeah.
And I'd collect the gourds and my foreman would varnish them, take them home, varnish them, and then give them as gifts, as ornaments. Yes.
Yes. So, yeah, it's a lovely thing to pick.
Yeah.
And that, of course, will preserve. It stops the decay of the gourd and it means they preserve, and you could have it on, you know, the mantelpiece and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, there's always a use. There's always a use. That's been an absolutely fascinating trip that we've just had. Thank you ever so much, Martin and Chris.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all we've got time for this month, but thanks so much to Martin and to Chris for joining me on the Organic Gardening Podcast and, of course, Raymond Blanc OBE. Do come back again next month when we'll be hearing botanical insights from Helena Dove, who runs the kitchen garden at Kew. All that's left for me to do now is to thank Kevin MacLeod for the music, and we'll see you next time.